You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 205 by Rudolf Steiner, 13 lectures entitled The Human Being as Body and Soul in Relation to the Cosmos, translated by William Forward. This is Lecture 10, given in Dornach on the 10th of July, 1921. At the end of yesterday's lecture, I pointed out that the vernal equinox has made a complete circuit of the zodiac from Pisces to Pisces, and that the starting point, according to the findings of spiritual research, was the beginning of humanity's development on Earth. This must, of course, be understood in the right way. Looking at the evolution of humanity in its entirety, we would have to say that it had its beginnings in the time of old Saturn. The cycle we spoke of earlier is therefore only a part of the whole course of humanity's development on Earth. We can also look at the process in this way. Human beings took shape in significantly different ways in each of their phases of development, from Saturn through Sun and Moon, none of which can be compared with the current human form. If we are now addressing the development of the human form on Earth, it implies that the preparation for this physical existence took place at the end of the Lemurian Age in the way I have described in my written works, and continued on to the Atlantean Age, that is, precisely for the time involved in such a complete cycle of the vernal equinox. Today we shall expand a little on the circumstances affecting us during the time we returned to our point of departure. I would like to show you what I actually mean by this in the form of an illustration. It would not be correct to represent human development since the last part of the Lemurian era, where the vernal equinox was in the sign of Pisces, as a circle, simply returning on itself. That would be wrong. We have to think of this circle, which is of course only an image of the developmental process, as a spiral. We have to think of it so that if the starting point of our development in the old Lemurian era was here, and then returned to its point of departure, with humanity having reached a higher state of development, in relation to the cosmos, we have returned in the present age to our point of departure, but at a higher level of development. We shall now consider how we have to live in these new surroundings. Some time ago I spoke to a smaller group in Stuttgart about a possible astronomical perspective on our world in its context. I have shown how for a long time the Ptolemaic view of the world was considered the correct one. It was certainly intelligent and summarized in a series of geometrical lines what needs to be summarized, if we want to express what we see of the stars in their positions, relations, and movements in image form. Then, due to a variety of circumstances, which I have often referred to, the Ptolemaic system was replaced by the Copernican system, which, with certain substantial amendments, is still regarded as correct today. In Stuttgart, I showed that the Copernican system is likewise only a compilation of linear perspectives on what we see with our eyes or telescopes or anything else when we look out into the cosmos. And I went on to show that the Copernican system is by no means so very much more accurate a representation than the Ptolemaic system. It is only a different way of interpreting the phenomena. I then tried to summarize the phenomena myself, in relation to what we ourselves can experience when, for example, the Earth moves in a certain way and carries us with it. Today I only want to present the result, since the rest of the process is not important for us. Now, if we try to condense the phenomena down to a simple cosmic system that one could represent with a pencil or a globe, while avoiding the one-sided Ptolemaic or Copernican systems, but taking into account all the phenomena that present themselves, it becomes so complicated that we would soon come to the conclusion that it simply can't be done. It is essentially impossible to summarize these things simply in the way we normally like to. As a result, we come to something quite remarkable, which I would like to show you, because however paradoxical it may seem to our modern consciousness, it needs discussion. It is commonly held that present-day natural science is the cleverest thing that there's ever been, and that essentially nothing could be cleverer. This belief, however, is leading us toward a cultural disaster. Somehow we will still have to find a way to present the reality. The more we take individual circumstances into account, the more likely we are to be overwhelmed by the complexity of the cosmos and to feel as we do when we have just woken up and experienced the chaotic images in our life of soul, which I described to you yesterday and the day before, as a kind of sub-current in our consciousness. I illustrated the human organism in terms of an etheric body and a physical body, and added, these chaotic images turn up which are in fact also always present during the daytime. They occur very actively in people who are inclined to be dreaming, but we all find them deep inside us. They are particularly noticeable in the morning, when our ego and astral bodies dive back down into our physical and etheric bodies. What I am referring to is not the images themselves, which according to the state of development of the individuals involved can of course be poetic or imaginative or indeed be totally chaotic, which is more often the case, but rather the mood of soul that comes over us when, as fairly logical people, used to thinking logically, we are immersed in this world of images. The mood of soul, I mean, is how one feels when one has put aside all prejudices and oversimplifications, which tend to come up when one is trying to systematize the world and simply approaches the task entirely without prejudice. Eventually, the complexity and the way in which everything is interwoven will induce a kind of mood of soul. Of course, our culture has brought it about, and most people find it very reassuring, that every school child knows the sun is at the focal point of an ellipse. The planets revolve around it. The fixed stars do not move, and so on. Every school child knows this, and it is very simple. However, if we look at the phenomena without preconceptions or any theoretical constructs, we will find that they are not simple at all, but become increasingly complex, and eventually we end up with the feeling I described earlier. We have to reach the point where we pass from the clearly determined to the indeterminate, from clearly defined lines to problematic ones. We begin to feel, what you are taking into your head is an image, a woven image, which you can, of course, simplify, just as you can make a sketch of one of Raphael's Madonnas. However, you would not then have the full Raphael Madonna before you. And similarly, the Copernican system presents us with the cosmos in the form of an image, which contains an infinite number of details and distinct elements. The moment you take this into consideration, you will realize, when, eventually, we have to admit to our limitations in the face of the complexity of the phenomena in the cosmos, we will also have to admit that we are incapable of fully confronting reality as such. The mood in which we meet what is coming toward us is like the mood in which we meet the world of images when we wake up out of the cosmos every morning and enter into our bodies. So there is no question of us facing reality. These are the sort of considerations we will have to take into account if we want to develop a mental picture in the true sense of the word of what is meant by the following. With our present consciousness, we live in a world of illusion, of Maya. With the image we have constructed for ourselves of the cosmos and its phenomena, we are also living in Maya. The same is true of the impressions made on us by the world around us, woven together through our senses. We would certainly not develop the clumsy theory of knowledge that emerged at the end of the 18th century and on into the 19th century, constantly repeating the idea that the phenomena are out there, produced according to the laws of mechanics or dynamics, and to be understood in terms of waves, or, as is being said more recently, electrons, which make impressions on our senses. What we perceive is thus only the effect of what is out there, and hence only the appearance of reality. To talk in this way about the appearance of reality really is a clumsy theory of knowledge, which can lead to all kinds of peculiar experiences. These days we only need to make a couple of references here and there to the shortcomings of this theory of knowledge, and someone will pop up and say, quote, "But Kant said," close quote. People have become so entangled in this web of Kantianism that they treat him like some kind of Bible, at least many people do. They make certain adjustments, but on the whole he is regarded as a kind of Bible. This can lead to strange encounters. I once gave some lecture courses on the topic in Berlin during the winter of 1900 to 1901, the very same winter in which Herr von Gleich proclaimed that a certain winter had instructed me in theosophy. He mistook the winter of 1900 to 1901 for a Herr Winter who is supposed to have given me instruction in theosophy. I don't know if he had read it somewhere, or if someone had told him that I gave these lectures in the winter, which were subsequently published as having been given in the winter of 1900 to 1901 in Berlin, and then the word winter was taken to refer to Herr Winter by name. Well, this argument is no more intelligent than the other stupid and untruthful arguments put forward by General von Gleich. But there was also a dyed-in-the-wool Kantian who actually attended these lectures. I can't say he was listening, since most of the time he was asleep, and I don't know how many people are capable of listening while they sleep. But I did notice that this gentleman only woke up when he could make some reference to Kant. It then happened that I repeated an argument, not one of mine, which maintained that if we really refer to the thing in itself in the way Kant did, that is, that it is completely unknown, then it might consist of pins, and that indeed pins might be behind all sense impressions. The moment I said this, the gentleman in question jumped as if he had been bitten by a tarantula and said, quote, "There is neither space nor time behind phenomena. Needles exist in space, and so the thing in itself could not possibly consist of pins," close quote. This is just one example of many incidents that occur when people believe that their Bible, their Kantian Bible, has somehow been tampered with. Now, it really is not the case that somehow any old things in themselves will throw effects into us, which will then trigger sensory qualities in us, so that we are cocooned in our own sensory qualities. It's just not like that. The correct description is quite different. I would ask you to do the following. Stand outside at 11 a.m., for example, and look at your surroundings carefully, unlike the way some people sketch them. That approach is pointless because those sketches cannot render the sensory appearances correctly. Look at your surroundings at 11 a.m. and 12 noon, including all the light effects playing on them. The entire sensory fabric will have completely changed at 12 noon, and again at 5 and 8 p.m. The picture spread out before you is constantly changing. You are never dealing with anything other than interwoven effects. Take a tree. What part of the tree do you see? You see the light reflected back, you may see the leaves stirred by the wind, and so on. In short, you will never see anything constant. What you see will simply be an objective appearance. Where the clumsy theory of knowledge talks of a subjective appearance, you actually see an objective appearance, and this naturally communicates itself to the eye, EYE. Just as a tree absorbs the rays of light in a certain way, reflects them, and so on, your eye is in a particular relationship to the light rays, and we can say, the world of phenomena, of appearances, surface reality, the Maya nature that is spread out in the world, which we can sense around us, is of course present in the subjective image we form. But, because it is objectively changeable, our subjective image is also changeable. This is just what I wanted to establish in the first section of my title, Philosophy of Spiritual Activity, or in my little book, titled Truth and Science. So even when we are looking at the world in front of us, we are not dealing with a permanent, lasting reality. We are dealing with what is coming and going at any given moment. We are concerned with appearances. If we wanted to construct this image theoretically, we would be no better off than we were with a few lines sketched of the Sistine Madonna. That is how it is with everything that we relate to outside us. We are placed in a world of phenomena, of Maya. But despite the fact that we are in this world with all our sensory capacities, we are not dependent on it. What is quite clear to us is that when we come out of the cosmos every morning and dive into our etheric and physical bodies with our astral body and I, capital, what we are diving into is something objective and has its own truth. Of course, the chaotic images that swirl around us are only appearance on the surface. But what we are diving into contains something true in its essence. The moment we dive into our bodies, whether we say to ourselves, I want to move my limbs, or I want my thoughts to become imaginative pictures, or I want to organize my thoughts in some logical sequence, we know that what happens when we dive into our bodies is something that does not depend entirely on us. We receive it. It takes us into itself. The moment of waking up is the moment that gives us our feeling of identity. This feeling of identity weaves and waves its course through our entire experience of thinking. Our thoughts themselves connect more with the world of phenomena, appearance, Maya. Let us now extend what I have described by means of our ordinary, everyday experiences to encompass the whole human being. Anyone who can contemplate the whole human being with the insights that can be gained from my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds will soon see how our soul and spirit aspect passes through the condition we are in between death and a new birth, and then penetrates into the physical world. It embodies itself in order to experience the condition we are in between birth and death, and then once again experiences the world between death and a new birth. I have already set out some important details of these processes in my recent lectures here. When we have developed our consciousness to the point where we can look back into the world that exists before our birth or conception, we will observe the world that consists of what gives us our sense of identity is the one we have passed through on our journey between death and a new life. A true sense of identity that is not susceptible to feelings of doubt or skepticism can only come from an ability to look back into the world of our existence before our conception. But now we come to a significant factor. You will find this in my lectures given in Vienna in the spring of 1914, but this time I want to present it in a different form. It is revealed in something that comes toward us before we start our descent into physical embodiment, and while we are still in the human condition, between death and a new birth. What happens during this time is that we increasingly lose our appetite for existence, for being who we are. As we develop during the period between death and a new birth, we go through a process of complete saturation with the experience of being who we are. This is one of the things that humanity attains between death and the new birth, namely that once we have passed through the first stages after death, the relationship we have to the world we are entering involves us becoming deeply infused with a sense of being anchored in the being of the world. This becomes stronger and stronger to the point where we experience a kind of oversaturation with our sense of self. And then, toward the end of the time, between death and a new birth, a complete oversaturation with our sense of self takes place. I could also put this in a different way. We begin to experience a real hunger for a feeling of non-existence. The beings of soul and spirit who come down to earth as human beings show a strong hunger for non-existence. This attitude of soul and spirit means that out of our hunger for non-existence, we plunge into Maya, into the world that we see before us among the stars and in the phenomena of the earthly world. It is a yearning for a world of non-being, a world which affects us in the way that chaotic impressions do when we seek for what underlies it, a world that shows us a different face every time we look at it. As we live our way into this world, we find ourselves completely enveloped by surface appearances, the world of Maya. Our spiritual and soul nature wants to plunge into this world of Maya. That is what we have to face. Other aspects of our new existence are more or less side effects. It is the strongest impulse in our soul and spiritual nature as we approach our earthly existence, this yearning for Maya, this yearning for soft and permeable phenomena, as opposed to being saturated with the sense of our own being. The etheric and physical bodies that are then wrapped around us are born out of the cosmos. During the last few days, I have explained how the embryo in our mother's body is formed out of the cosmos. What we thus have to imagine is this. Each of us actually comes from a completely different world, a world in which is developed this hunger for non-being, for a life within Maya as we approach physical existence. Our eye and astral bodies are then received by our etheric and physical bodies, and there's a sketch. These are formed out of the cosmos on conception as our earthly clothing. We have come from a world that has neither space nor time, which cannot be found in space, but are nevertheless clothed in space with what has been prepared in our mother's body. We dip back into this every time we wake up. As we fall asleep, we emerge from it once more. We then develop a rhythmical relationship with our bodily nature, dipping into it and emerging from it. Today's way of thinking makes it very difficult to deal with reality. It is hard to explain these processes appropriately to the science of our day, because the necessary concepts are lacking. For example, how a completely different stream, which a person has been following before coming to embodiment, is linked to the outer garment in which the individual is wrapped, but with which the individuality had previously had no substantial connection. I have explained how it really comes about on other occasions. The same is true in other contexts. When physiologists talk about light or color today, they are primarily concerned with describing something or other that the eye, EYE, does. In reality, this is rather like someone wanting to describe one or other of the people sitting here, and then mainly focusing on the carpenter's workshop here, because that is where the person came in. Essentially, the light that enters the eye and has its impact on it has little more to do with it than you have with the carpenter's workshop, once you have walked in and are enclosed within it. If someone is describing you and the workshop, both will naturally be described as a whole, but that doesn't happen. It remains a hard task to find the truth in the face of today's convoluted thought processes. We can summarize the issue as follows. The spiritual and soul aspects of our being come to this earthly world primarily on account of this urge toward non-being. Then every waking moment experienced, that is, in the time between waking up and going to sleep, is a new education toward being, a new imbuing of consciousness with being. Human beings in the condition we were in between death and a new birth are so happy when they can come to their physical incarnation. I have often described how the brain floats in its cerebral fluid. If the entire weight of the brain, 1,350 grams roughly, were to press down on the blood vessels beneath, they would be squashed and could not function. But the downward pressure amounts to no more than about 20 grams. Why? Because our brain is floating in cerebral fluid. You will be familiar with the Archimedean principle. It was Archimedes who discovered it. He was in a bathtub one day and noticed how he became lighter and lighter in the bath and was so delighted by this discovery that he jumped out of the bath at once and ran through the streets naked. A scientific researcher would have found it easier to do that in those days than in ours, shouting, "I've got it! I've got it!" This was the principle, that if you have a vessel with water in it, then place a solid object into it. The object will become lighter than it is outside the vessel and by the weight of the water it has displaced. If you imagine it as made of water, it would have become lighter by its own weight in water. In this way, the brain loses all but 20 grams of its weight, pressing down with only 20 grams because it is floating in cerebral fluid. Our brain is thus not constrained by its own full weight. It is buoyed up. The force that brings this about is also known as buoyancy. As we incarnate, we look forward to coming into something that draws us upward, really draws us upward. We learn what it is to be heavy from the remaining 20 grams, and heaviness teaches us to feel our own selfhood. We are once more imbued with the sense of self between birth and death. It is then extended and increased in the development we go through after death. This has lapsed from the consciousness of modern humanity to such an extent that the greatest philosopher at the time this newer awareness was dawning, Cartesius, or Descartes, coined the phrase, "Cogito ergo sum," I think, therefore I am. This is the most nonsensical phrase one could imagine, for it is precisely in the act of thinking that we cease to exist. We are outside existence at that moment. Cogito ergo non sum is the true reality. We are so far removed from true reality today that the greatest philosopher of the modern age could formulate the truth as its opposite. We acquire our sense of self precisely when our thinking experiences itself within our organism, when it feels embedded in what is heavy. This is not merely a popular image. It is the reality expressed in the phenomena. Moreover, this can teach us how, from our position before conception, we knowingly make our way down to earth, submerge ourselves in Maya, and from within Maya learn what we are going to need again after death, the experience of selfhood. What I am describing to you now is something that is specifically human in our development. This rhythmic passing from a sense of being to non-being is something you could imagine as part of a meditation in the following way. When you are merely concerned with your thoughts, I am not. When you are living in your will, which physically lives in your metabolism and limbs, you could say, I am. What lies between our metabolic human nature and our purely brain-bound nature, which will say, I am not, if it fully understands itself, for it is only images that live in the brain, is the rhythmic alternation between I am and I am not. The outer physical expression of this is the breathing process. Our exhalation fills our breathing process with what comes from our metabolic process with carbon dioxide. I am is exhaling. I am not is inhaling. The inhalation is related to the I am not of thinking. Inhalation involves drawing breath into our rib cage, pressing the water in the arachnoidal cavity upward, and thus also the cerebral fluid. We bring the oscillation of our breathing process into our brain. That is the organ of thinking. The inhalation process transmitted to the brain, I am not. Breathing out again, the cerebral fluid presses down through the arachnoidal cavity into the diaphragm. Exhalation, air turned into carbon dioxide. I am, from the depths of the will. Exhalation, out of the will. All this is a purely human process if regarded in this way. Anyone who wishes to attribute this to animals, since they also breathe, is like someone taking a razor blade to cut their meat with on the grounds that it is a knife. Of course, animals breathe too, but animal breathing is quite different from human breathing, just as a razor blade is different from a table knife. Making definitions on the basis of external appearances only will never lead to any useful understanding of the world. Death is different in each case, as human beings, animals, and plants. If you start with the definition of death, your explanation will be no more useful than defining a knife as something that is so thin on one side that it cuts through other objects. The general concept is all very well, but does not help us to understand the actual reality. What I have just described to you are specifically human processes. These are processes that human beings have gone through during the time the vernal equinox passed from the sign of Pisces and back again to the sign of Pisces. This is precisely the period of the Earth's development, during which peoples at the forefront of the process went through the most essential aspects of what I have just described to you, and indeed everything that enables us to see what happens when we descend into the physical world through birth, plunge into Maya, and are then born out of Maya at the moment of death, enriched by the sense of self that will be needed for life going on after death. This is an extremely important fact. Being born out of life through death and with a sense of self, and on the other hand, how coming to birth on earth is a plunging of our soul and spiritual being into the world of Maya. It is precisely the fact that we are plunging into Maya, a world of images, that enables us to be free. We could never be free if we lived in a world of facts with the consciousness we have between birth and death. We are only free in that we live in a world of images. Images in a mirror do not determine us causally. A world of facts would. What you bring toward the picture hanging in front of you must come from you. The world of appearances here does not determine us in respect to what in my title Philosophy of Spiritual Activity I described as pure thinking, which does not emerge from our organism. What comes out of our organism, as you will have seen, is saturated with a sense of self. Although in the case of our brains, it is present in such a small percentage that it amounts to roughly 20 parts to 1,350. We have to constantly take that into consideration When we think of how we develop this yearning for Maya as we are born into this earthly world, and how living on the earth teaches us to develop a sense of our identity. That is what we have been going through during the time between the last Lemurian epoch and our own, amounting to a solar cycle of 25,920 years, a great world cycle. Now we have reached the time in which this period of development has returned to its point of departure. And as I indicated, it should be represented diagrammatically in spiral form rather than as a circle. Developing humanity has returned to its point of departure, but on a higher level. What is meant by this higher level? It means that until now we humans have plunged into Maya at birth and have then acquired a sense of our own identity out of this physical existence. However, the earth itself has also undergone a transformation and is no longer the same organism that it was in the Lemurian or Atlantean epochs. Today, the earth is in a process of dissolution. This is also known to geologists. Read the beautiful geological writings of Edward Suess, titled The Face of the Earth. Quote, "The earth is in a process of crumbling, a process of dissolution." Close quote. The effect of this is that we now no longer have every opportunity to adequately develop our sense of individual being. Now that we have completed a cycle in the way I described yesterday and today, we face the danger of going through death without having developed a sufficient sense of our own individual being, because the earth no longer provides the necessary intensity of individual experience. This new period, which I have now described to you as a period affecting the entire cosmos, confronts humanity with the prospect of going through death with too strong a feeling of levity, if I may put it like that. We may become more and more materialistic, but the consequence will be that we will have an inadequate sense of our own weight, of our own individual being, on passing through the threshold of death. This is already quite clear today to anyone who is familiar with how things are in the cosmos of our time. Souls are now passing through the gate of death, who are in a sense being borne aloft by their own feeling of non-being, so that they experience the opposite of someone falling into the water who is unable to swim and sinks. These souls sink upward when they pass through the gate of death, owing to their own lack of gravity. The way in which the term gravity is used in the spiritual world is illustrated at a significant moment in my mystery plays. Quote, "They rise up and are lost." Close quote. This can only be prevented if people are prepared to make the effort to rise above the concepts that come of their own accord and feature throughout their lives, and strive toward what requires a certain amount of exertion in physical life, that is, concepts that do not derive from physical life alone, but which have to be acquired through spiritual science. What do people tend to say about spiritual science who wish to stay with the conventional way of thinking of our day? They will tell you, quote, "Well, if you take, for example, what is described in Steiner's title Occult Science, it's fantasy, it's random, it's impossible to imagine it." Close quote. Why do people say this? They can see chalk, tables, legs, and they can only imagine what appears before them in this way. They don't want to imagine anything other than the outer physical reality they are used to. They don't want to become inwardly active in their thinking. If you want to study title Occult Science, you will have to exert yourself. If you stare at an ox, you will be facing a reality, it is true, but you will not need to make any effort. You will only need to stare at the ox and then form a so-called concept, which is not really a concept at all. The point is that these concepts indicated by spiritual science, such as, for example, my title Occult Science or title Theosophy or the other books, require this inner activity. With humanity having become so extremely materialistic today, a large number of people, spiritualists, are particularly reluctant to engage with thinking through, working through, the content of titled occult science. They prefer to have something conjured up for them by Schrenk Notzing or others like him. Humanoid lumps or things of that nature, so that they can remain completely passive. No effort is required of them. The problem is that one then becomes increasingly lightweight, working against continued existence after death. On the other hand, fully engaging with the activity necessary to penetrate into spiritual science requires us to exert ourselves physically more than we normally would in so-called normal circumstances. One is obliged to give the concepts more weight. That has the effect of enabling us to carry our sense of self with us through death and being capable of facing life after death. This is what people like so much today, adding nothing to what life brings toward them. If they have to add something, become inwardly active, they immediately start to feel uncomfortable. In society in general, people have always tried to learn as much as possible on the basis of the templates prescribed by the state. When we have happily reached the age of 25 or 26, and are student teachers, articled clerks, or graduate trainees, we are pushed into some scheme or other and are entitled to a pension after so and so many years, then we are secure. Although we are only in our 20s, we are assured for the rest of our lives. We have our bodies pensioned, that is assured from the outset. Then comes the church according to our faith, which also demands no more from us than that we passively devote ourselves to what is on offer. The church then provides the pension for our souls when we are dead. This is assured without us having to do anything other than keeping the faith, just as our bodies were covered by a pension earlier. This is something that must be broken with if we are not to see culture go into total decline. What is required is inner activity, active inner collaboration with what people are able to make of themselves, even with regard to their immortal beings. We must work for our immortality. That is what most people would prefer to have conjured magically away. They believe that knowledge can only teach us about what already exists, and at best can only tell us that we are immortal beings. There are people who say, quote, well, this is where I live with whatever life brings. As to what happens after death, well, we'll see when the time comes. Close quote. They will see nothing, absolutely nothing. This argument is about as intelligent as the one advanced by Atzengruber's character, quote, sure as there is a God in heaven, I am an atheist. Close quote. The logic behind both positions is the same. The fact is that as far as our spirit and soul nature are concerned, we help our spirit to grow and mature by including it in our search for knowledge, and so prevent it from going through the opposite experience of someone who is sinking while swimming, that is, rising up with no sense of their own being. We must work at our own being to ensure that it can pass through death in the right way. Acquiring spiritual knowledge is not acquiring abstract knowledge, but involves penetrating our spirit and soul nature with the forces that overcome death. In truth, that is the essence of the Christian doctrine, after all. Thus we are not merely to believe in Christ, as more recent confessions would have it, but rather to take to heart the words of St. Paul, quote, yet not I, but the Christ in me. Close quote. We must want to develop the power of Christ in ourselves and to form it within ourselves. Belief is not in itself sufficient to save us. Only inner collaboration with the Christ, inner work at acquiring the power of Christ, which is, after all, always present when we wish to develop it within ourselves, but which has to be worked for. we will have to fill ourselves with initiative and activity. And we will have to recognize that purely passive belief will simply make us too light, so that immortality on earth would gradually die out. That is what Ahriman is working toward. We shall find out the extent to which this is Ahriman's intention in the next lecture, since we are now placed between the conflicting powers of Lucifer and Ahriman. Just as we have to some extent preserved our unconsciousness while the vernal equinox completed a full cycle, we shall have to embark on the next cycle in the full knowledge of what is weaving through the being of worlds, the battle between the Ahrimanic and Luciferic spirits. Spiritual science leads us into reality, not into a purely abstract knowledge. More of this the next time we meet. The end of Lecture 10.